Welcome to The Final Word, a Bible teaching ministry with pastor, teacher, and author Jim Andrews. The Final Word is grounded on the invincible conviction that what the Bible teaches, God teaches. And that is the last word. On this program, truth still matters. The Bible is in, Babel is out. The Final Word is funded by listeners like you. Should you want to partner with us or want other information about the program, please go to our website at thefinalwordradio.com. There you'll find archives so you can listen to any program you may have missed. Visit us on our social media platforms at The Final Word Radio and write us a note. We love hearing from our listeners. We'll provide other contact information at the end of the program, so have your pen ready. And now Jim Andrews continues his current study of God's Word.
Good day, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for joining us again on The Final Word. Before I launch today's exposition, I want to make our listening audience aware, in case any of you are not, of some articles that I have written that you might be interested in and tell you how to access them. Over the years, I have done a good deal of writing to prepare resources that I think should be helpful to my congregation and also helpful to you, our listeners. So grab a pen and paper and get prepared to write down a website. If you will go to jimandrewsbooks.com, that's one word, jimandrewsbooks.com, you will find there a tab that says Articles. If you will open that with your cursor, you will discover there are some articles that I've produced over the years that you may find interesting and helpful. I'm not a regular blogger, but when things pop up on my radar that I feel I would like to address in a thoughtful way, I will sometimes produce a longer article. So I'm just happy to share them with you for whatever benefit they may have. Now, back to our current study.
We continue our exposition of 2 Samuel. We're in 2 Samuel chapter 20. We pick up in the vicinity of verse 10. The fallout, the ramifications of David's great sin, according to the prophet Nathan, keep showing up in the narrative. David had replaced Joab, finally, as the general of his army. Once David was safely ensconced back in power after the civil war between he and his rebellious son, Absalom, David has to pull the people of Israel back onto his side, and Joab had kind of overstayed his welcome and had been out of line so many times that David finally decides Joab needs a little discipline, been too presumptuous. He's under a curse anyway that David had imposed upon him way back in the time of Abner, whom Joab so treacherously murdered. Now he replaces him with a relative by the name of Amasa. But Amasa was not getting the job done, and so David does not reinstate Amasa, but his brother Abishai in that place, but Joab goes with him to do the job that David had sent him to do, to chase down a rebel by the name of Shabna, the Bichrite. He had to be corralled before he had a chance to do enormous damage, more than Absalom had ever done. So haste, in this case, was not waste. It was of the essence. But when Joab encounters Amasa, he catches him off guard, and he murders him just like he murdered Abner. Now, we were raising the question in our last study, why did David not deal with Joab? Why had he always kind of deferred to the Lord to deal with him? We had explained that, and that led us to a discussion, and you can turn to the archives to get this about politics. There was politics in David's administration. I explained there's politics in everything. There's good politics, there's bad politics. It's a value-neutral term. There's nothing wrong with politics. It's just a human dynamic that's present even in the family. The trouble is our fallen natures import into that dynamic oftentimes a lot of foul things that give it a bad name. It's like marriage sometimes gets a bad name, not because there's anything wrong with marriage, but by the way we sometimes conduct our marriages. That's what we were last dealing with. Well, Amasa is cruelly murdered. So the action rolls on. The troops are out in the field, though Abishai is the official general in charge. His older brother Joab is there, and in the strength of his military personality, though he's not the de jure leader, he is the de facto leader in charge. and after Joab's murder of Amasa, described in verses 8 through 10. Joab and his brother Abishai, they left Amasa, their relative, gutted in the middle of the road, and they proceed to pursue their quarry, Shabna the Bichrite. The signal to move out was given by one of Joab's young lieutenants, who cried out to any with divided loyalty, "Whoever favors Joab as opposed to the slain Amasa, and whoever is for David, let him declare his loyalty to the throne, follow Joab." However, the shock of the sudden brutal murder of their leader, Amasa, lying there wallowing in his own blood in the middle of the road like a slaughtered animal, so stunned the army of Amasa that they were more or less paralyzed at the command to move out in pursuit of Shabna the Bichrite. Seeing that immobilizing effect, the lieutenant of Joab, I take it, awarded Amasa, the slain Amasa, the final dignity of at least covering his body with some kind of garment, moved the corpse out of the middle of the road to the side so that it would not be walked over by the departing troops like roadkill. That he had to do that is quite a commentary on the brutalization of war, a commentary on the callousness of its leaders, Abishai and Joab, at this point in time. One can just feel oozing from the narratives a day of divine reckoning, making its way to retribution, though at present God is using Joab to help David despite himself. It was no credit to Joab, mind you, but it was a testimony to God's determination to fulfill his promises, even through far less the noble people. Folks, God will do no wrong, but he does know how to use those who will do wrong to accomplish what is right. In verse 13, as he was removed from the highway, all the men passed on after Joab to pursue Shabna, the son of Bichri. Mistreating anyone on the team has a way of deflating the morale of all. That seems to be what happened here. There was an insufferable indignity to one, Amasa, that resulted in the inertia of the whole army. Until one man saw it and relieved the problem, that reminds me of another thing to note here about the dynamics of leadership. You can appoint someone the leader of a mission or an enterprise, but you cannot make them a leader. Abishai was the formal leader, but Joab, as I mentioned, good or bad, was the real leader of these troops. In leadership, one is always smart to identify the real leader or leaders among those who are just the formal leaders. Sometimes, as in this case, formal leaders are put in place for political purposes, as here. But when it comes to getting the mission accomplished, the real leaders are the ones you have to depend on. They always rise to the surface. Well, now in verse 14, the chase of Shabna begins in earnest. His pursuers head north of the Sea of Galilee to a fortified city near the Lake of Merom called Abel Beth Maaca, where Shabna had taken refuge. Once they tracked Shabna to that city, Joab and his army wasted no time trying to coax him out by gentle or diplomatic means. In verse 15, Joab assumed the city was friendly to their criminal guest, so on that assumption he hastened to throw up siege works. He intended to bring the city to its knees and Shabna to the sword. And we see in verse 15 they began wreaking destruction in order to topple the wall. Joab was a man of war. He always seemed to prefer to accomplish his ends by bloodshed rather than by peaceful diplomacy. He seemed not even to consider that option before he hit the city guns blazing, as it were, like the Terminator. He lacked any sense of the great cities of Israel functioning as mothers of a nation or nurturers of its citizens. Right now, all Joab saw was short-sighted. The only thing he could see was Shabna ensconced in a well-fortified hiding place. He, John Wayne-like, was going to force this badger from his hole, no matter if he had to destroy a mother of Israel, destroy one of its cities famed for the wisdom of some of its citizens, verse 18. Well, in the midst of the deconstruction of the city walls, we read that a wise woman called from the city, "Hear, hear, please tell Joab, come here that I may speak with you." Well, wisdom is an equal opportunity employer. Wisdom will use whoever will welcome her. And this woman was one of those. God gave her a voice at this time of crisis that got heard. It got heard even by a crusty, curmudgeonly warrior like Joab. A wise woman is priceless, as was Abigail in the case of David. Joab approached her, and the woman said, "Are you Joab?" He answered, "You can almost hear the voice of John Wayne." "I am." She said to him, "Listen to the words of your maidservant." And he answered, "I am listening." She reproached him a bit for his shoot-first-ask-questions-later approach to his mission, which apparently he had not even bothered to explain to the populace. He came to his task with no sense of history. Did he not know or care that he and his troops were systematically destroying a mother in Israel, of which this woman was a symbol? Was he not aware that this was an iconic city to which the Israelites for the longest time had taken recourse in search of wisdom, wisdom so regularly found there in the form of advice? It might as well have been called Ann Landers when it came to dispensing advice. Yet here's Joab with his brutal, bloody hand, surrounded by an army of Philistines, as it were, no questions asked, proceeding to dismantle this great city and trash the inheritance of the Lord. That is, trash what belonged to the Lord and placed in trusteeship in Israel. This woman, this wise woman, is making Joab look terribly heavy-handed, making him look like a stampeding elephant, destroying all this good for the sake of some ant. Belatedly, Joab explains the seriousness of the situation that brought his army to their walls. This should have happened long ago. But in his case, this haste makes waste the way he's going about it. What can be achieved by peaceful means, folks, is always better than what can be achieved by violent means. There are those, of course, who wildly overestimate what can be achieved by peaceful means. Always get amused at these people running around with these bumper stickers that say, "War is not the answer." I just always want to stop them and say, "Well, dear, will you please tell me, what is the answer? Do you think with some of these people in the world that we deal with, that just going out and making nice will cause them to say, 'Oh, you're so nice. I didn't know that. Well, let's party.'" How naive. Well, it takes a wise woman to talk Joab down out of his war tree and to accomplish his mission by diplomacy rather than by destruction. And what a lesson here. Always try communication before one gets hell-bent on destruction. Well, Joab, a bit shamed, he disowns any desire to swallow up or destroy any part of the Lord's inheritance. That sure could have fooled the population inside those walls. Verse 21, he explains his mission. He explains there's a bad guy from the hill country of Ephraim. He explains that he's lifted up his revolting hand against King David. And he adds that this fellow, his intelligence, Joab's intelligence, has learned, is hiding behind her skirt, as it were. "We've come for him. You just hand him over, we'll be gone." What comes last should have come first. Sometimes it reminds us we don't pray and reflect before we act and do a lot of damage, before somebody with better sense tells us what sensible thing we ought to have done in the first place. And so here, the wise woman knows Shebna is not a man in step with the spirit of the city. She knows that the presence of Shebna's kind in the midst of those who are peaceable and faithful in Israel should not be tolerated. So she asks Joab, "Hold the phone." She goes back and communicates her message to the city fathers. With certitude, she assures Joab that, in a jiffy, Shebna's head will be thrown to you over the city wall. She was wise enough to know that a little leaven leavens the whole lump, and wise men will not suffer fools to go to root in their midst. They would deal with it, and they would deal with it swiftly. So after consulting with all the people, they acted as she predicted. They seized Shebna. They cut off his head. They threw it over the wall to Joab. With that action, Joab blew the trumpet to signal retreat. From there, he dismissed his army to return to their homes, and Joab returned to David in Jerusalem. Inasmuch as David had been reinstated by the popular will as the rightful king over Israel, the narrator now lists the key officials that constituted his administration after this time. The irrepressible Joab appears to be himself reinstated as David's chief military officer. David, painfully but clearly, needs him, and it's not yet God's time to deal with him. Besides, as noted before, politically David has found it would be very hard, and most especially at this time when national unity was still a bit frayed, to dismiss Joab from his position. Been there, seen that, it's tough to deal with, but sometimes you have to do it. It's better to ride with him than attempt to buck him off. Faithful Benaiah continues to be over David's loyal mercenary bodyguard. For the first time, we hear of an officer over forced labor. This forced labor population consists of foreigners conquered in battle. These were basically slaves who did whatever the state required them to do. Adoram was over these more or less public servants. Jehoshaphat was the recorder, or as some described the office, the archivist who kept the public records. Sheva was the scribe, the priest, Zadok, and Abiathar continued. They continued to serve, and David's personal priest is now Ira, the Jairite. Well, we come now to 2 Samuel chapter 21. Actually, we're kind of looking at chapter 21 through chapter 24 as kind of a unit. These chapters are most often characterized by scholars as an appendix to 2 Samuel because they are not tightly interwoven with the literary structure of the rest of the history. I personally am not comfortable with that description, but I do recognize that this material has a different cast than a simple continuation of the historical narrative that's gone before. However, as Robert P. Gordon has acknowledged, appendix, if we call that section by that term, does not mean materials just thrown in at the end in a haphazard fashion. On the contrary, 21 through 24, these chapters have a cohesive organization of their own. I quote Gordon, "At its center stand two poetic pieces, celebrating respectively Yahweh's delivering acts on behalf of David, and the other highlighting the covenantal relationship between Yahweh or the Lord and the house of David, upon which so much of Israel's hope for the future rests. These," he means acts of Yahweh, "we are reminded are the secret of David's greatness," I add, as opposed to any attributes or actions or assets belonging strictly to David himself. "Thus, let us remember, David was not a force of nature. He was not a man who, by dint of some special genius, accomplished all that he did. David was a man protected and blessed by the Lord God, blessed with all the protection and the provisions of the Lord, human and otherwise, blessed with all those things that David needed to fulfill his God-given role in redemptive history, his role as a type, a forerunner, a foreshadowing of the Messiah, David's greater descendant, who would in time appear as the Savior and the Lord of the universe." Chronologically, we do not know exactly where this episode in verse 21 fits into the reign of David. Just because it comes at the end of this book does not necessarily mean that it occurred at the end of David's reign. In fact, it has been pointed out by Gordon and others, depending on the timing of it, that the event narrated in chapter 21 could perhaps account for the curses of the infamous Shimei of the Saulite family, curses that Shimei showered upon David and his entourage. As David was fleeing Jerusalem, Shimei covered David up with a hail of invectives, accusing David of blood guilt for all the blood of the house of Saul. Now, none of that that I've said anyway mitigates or excuses Shimei's hateful actions and wrongful judgment against David. But if it did happen earlier, it's a way of seeing them in a light that at least would explain a great misunderstanding of David's royal actions in this case and account for Shimei's deep hatred for David. Afflictions strike a nation or a group or a family or an individual for various reasons. In the case of the faithful, afflictions come as testings. These adversities test, on one hand, the integrity of our faith. On the other hand, the jarring process serves to strengthen our faith like heavy winds tend to help sink the roots of a good tree deeper. On a corporate basis, adversities separate the wheat from the chaff. But these corporate afflictions where everybody suffers are often statement afflictions that something is wrong in the mix. It's what I call a red light moment that signals sin in the camp that needs to be identified and dealt with. We see these several times in the history of Israel. We have a case of the latter in this chapter. At some point in the latter part of David's reign, we presume, a great famine, those were not uncommon in that part of the world in those days, a great famine persisted in the land of Israel for 3 long years. The natural phenomenon were usually thought to have a supernatural reason. Today, they are not usually thought of in those terms in our so-called scientifically enlightened Western society. not thought of that way on the thin excuse that because we can explain weather-related disasters by scientific means, we can dismiss altogether the difference between natural means that God uses and the God of nature. That's so silly. The fact is, though today nobody is likely to say so, natural disasters will, I think, always have the same explanations the ancients regularly assumed. The hand of God, the sovereign hand of God, is in the mix for reasons moderns never bothered to contemplate and might not even be able to ever penetrate. Well, David was not one of those. He knew what to do. He turned to the Lord for revelation of what the problem was, and he got his answer. Now, there was a famine in the days of David for 3 years, year after year. David sought the presence of the Lord, and the Lord said, "It is for Saul and his bloody house," because Saul had put the Gibeonites to death. What David was told, either by direct revelation or through a royal prophet, was that this famine was a divine punishment on the sons of Israel for criminal bloodshed dating back to the reign of Saul. Now the bills are coming due, and they always do sooner or later unless there is repentance in the interim. It is that part that so regularly fools mankind. Strokes of divine justice delayed misleads sinful humans into thinking that sin does not usually find us out. Contrary to what the Lord has already revealed, be sure your sin will find you out. Saul was the head of his house. He was the official representative of Israel before God. We cannot miss that. Though the great sin of his against the Gibeonites is not elsewhere recorded in the biblical narratives, that it happened is beyond question, for the Lord declares his guilt, and his guilt passes to the nation itself on the corporate identity principle. The corporate identity principle is where the actions of one are accounted as the actions of all. For example, you will remember back in the book of Joshua, the case of Achan, the son of Carmi. Israel went into the land. They had strict instructions to put everything of value under a ban. They were not to harvest any trophies. So when the conquest of Jericho began, all of a sudden Israel unaccountably suffered a terrible military defeat, and it turned out that there was sin in the camp. The guilt of one affected all. It turns out that Achan secretly violated God's clear directions to ban all the booty taken from the Battle of Jericho. All of it was to be dedicated to destruction by God. But Achan couldn't resist, and he looted some of the valuables, and he hid them in his tent. I think it is safe to say that when God enforces this principle of corporate identity, I believe it is safe to say the group, whether a nation or a family, is seen in the mind of God as complicit to the guilt of the individual. Either they are known by God to be in sympathy with the sin in question, or they are indifferent to it, or in some way complicit with it. So all pay the price as accomplices, in the fact or after the fact. Now, since we do not know the circumstances of Saul's murder of the Gibeonites, we can only make some educated speculation. But first, we need some background from the book of Joshua to understand what this may have all been about. It all goes back to when Israel invaded the land of Canaan, and being victorious at every turn, they were approached by the Gibeonites under a ruse. We'll pick up this story the next time. Thank you, dear friends, for joining us on The Final Word. God bless you, and have a wonderful day.
The Final Word is a listener-supported ministry. Should you want to partner with us or want other information about this program, please visit our website at thefinalwordradio.com. Our postal address is The Final Word, 4565 Carmen Drive, Lake Oswego, Oregon, 97035. Our email address is info@thefinalwordradio.com. Our phone number is 503-699-9840. If this program has ministered to you, tell a friend about it. We do solicit your prayers for God's hand upon this outreach. Be sure.